Hi, and welcome to Hyperfixations, the podcast where we invite various interesting people on to talk about their niche area of interest so they could just talk forever about. Here are your hosts. I'm Ali.
And I'm Nigel.
And today we have Ella. Ella, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thank you. I am very excited about doing this. I am also playing an RPG tomorrow, like a tabletop game that is also on the theme of today's episode. So I'm swimming in everything that I'm obsessed with right now.
I thought you were going to say that the theme was somehow to do with hyperfixations, because then also I think like some form of RPG where like the player character's abilities are based off of their hyperfixations would be really interesting.
It would be, but I do think that it would never end. Like, you would start one session and then 3 weeks later you would still be in that session, because there would just be like one more thing that someone really, really, really needed to tell you about whatever their ability let them do because of its relevance to their hyperfixation. Like, I know that if that was me and my partner, we both have ADHD and autism, we would just get into, like, you know when like there's that computer coding thing where it just creates an infinite loop? That would be what would happen to us in that situation.
I feel like I
definitely think though it's something people could tweak and work with. So like RPG developers who are listening, get in that.
Exactly. And what is the theme of today's episode? What are you here to talk to about?
Dragon Age franchise. I'm here to talk about the Dragon Age franchise, the Dragon Age video game series, and sundry materials, including comics, novels, and the tabletop game. The Dragon Age franchise is what I am here to talk about. I feel very strongly about it.
Nice. Perfect.
So first of all, why Dragon Age? How did you first come to know Dragon Age? Why have you chosen it for this week's episode?
Okay, so a couple of things. So I came to Dragon Age because some friends of mine recommended it to me. I'd never heard of it, and my friends, no, that's not true. My partner had recommended it to me, and they're still really angry that I didn't listen because they recommended it. I didn't play because they recommended it. But some friends of mine recommended it, and specifically Dragon Age 2, and said, look, Dragon Age 2, you're going to be obsessed with the game. It's so much your personality. Like, you'll enjoy it so much. It's like a bi-crime found family of, like, weirdos and marginalized people in a magical high fantasy medieval setting. And I was like, cool. That does sound exactly like something I would want to play. I'll play that. And then I played it, and I lost control a little bit, and
you were like, I'm gonna make this my whole personality.
I really was. It has now been 4 years. It's fine. So like the reason that Dragon Age in particular really got under my skin is I was raised Catholic, but in a fairly abusive environment, which gave me a lot of like Christian trauma, and a lot of very strong feelings about the church in general, specifically the Catholic Church. But I also like attended a lot of Anglican churches. I studied the history of the church in Rome, and kind of like sort of how it was established at university. I studied like modern Christian ethics and theology. So it's something that like I've thought a fair bit about, and I think that there are many wonderful A, Christians, and B, branches of Christianity, and there's a lot of Christian thought that I think is very beautiful. And I want to be very clear up top that this is not something where I'm kind of slandering all churches with one brush. I don't think that's fair. I think even within like a specific branch of faith, like within, like, for example, Catholicism, there are individual churches which can be beautiful. There are individual Christians, Catholics, who can be wonderful people who follow beautiful principles. This is not a criticism. I also think, as a white person raised in a Christian country, raised to be Catholic, that it's very, very, very important to recognize and own the enormous violence practiced by the historical Catholic Church on like the rest of the world, and especially on women, queer people, disabled people, and people of color. And I also, frankly, personally think that that is a Christian responsibility. I think that if you look at the New Testament, it is a Christian responsibility to own that. I think you have to recognize the violence that has been done.
That is true.
Yeah, thank you. Dragon Age as a series is about that. and therefore it makes, but it's about that and queerness, and that makes me a little bit insane. So it does. Like, listen, I'm saying this as a mentally ill person with like four different mental illnesses. I'm not saying it in a derogatory way. It's just that I personally feel wild about this series. So the thing you have to understand about Dragon Age is a video game series. Is there's currently three games. The first one, Dragon Age Origins, was made by a primarily queer team of developers who wanted to make a game that on the surface seemed to be a kind of Dungeons and Dragons high medieval fantasy game. But underneath, the subtext was very much like the two romanceable queer characters talking about themes of queerness, colonialism, racial injustice, and spiritual abuse, and the ways in which the historical church facilitated empire and genocide against disabled people, people of color, and really like marginalized communities. And Dragon Age Origins as a game like really, really critiques the historical church and really kind of points out the hypocrisies in its like messaging whilst it's like sort of talking about forgiveness but actually exercising violence. It talks about queerness, it talks about trauma, it talks about sexual trauma. One of your romanceable characters is someone who has survived sexual abuse and rape, but is able to talk about it in like a really like well-written way that a lot of survivors like kind of really relate to. It's kind of really well done. He's also a male victim of sexual abuse, which you don't often, he's a male survivor of sexual abuse, and you don't get that as often. There's a lot of really cool stuff that Dragon Age Origins does like thematically in terms of what it's trying to say and why it's trying to say it. And especially in terms of like not only the history of the church in Europe, but specifically what Dragon Age Origins is doing is talking about how the history of the church in Europe and the violence that it did haunts the American imagination and American misconceptions of what the historical church was, because contemporary American Christianity does not understand the level of violence that the church in Europe did, and kind of valorizes it and creates this imaginary fairy tale version of the church that was always kind of like perfect and never did anything wrong ever, and doesn't even recognize that right now like the American church is doing a lot of violence to everyone. Sorry, someone just rang my doorbell. But I think my partner is going to get the door, so hopefully we should be good without another bell ring. Anyway, really cool queer team of developers makes this game that on the surface seems like just like a sort of a sword and fantasy thing, but actually turns into a really, really cool kind of critique of these injustices and proposes ways of kind of doing better. Like, so within the game, it's the message of the game isn't Christianity is evil. They're actually, one of the companions in the game is a woman who is Christian. She has faith, but her version of Christianity, like I say Christian, she's Andrastian, which is the Dragon Age church, but it's Christianity. But her version of Christianity is like, I think that we should be kind to sex workers and marginalized people, and that we should forgive people who have broken laws, and that we should recognize that kind of like the maker God like loves everyone, and we should treat everyone with kindness. And really interestingly, she
what a crazy radical position. Yeah,
I know, right?
Insane. Like,
exactly. And then she's kind of ousted from her church and seen as like a weird unstable radical because of this. And like, that is such a cool kind of mapping onto, again, historical Christianity and the kind of it like politics within the church. And then there's another character who, I mean, God knows, other people are able to speak to this better, but it must be recognized. Dragon Age, imagine a graph, which is like a plus sign kind of graph, right? And like on one axis is good as in I like it, and on one axis is bad as in I hate it, and on one axis is good as in well constructed, and on one axis is bad as in poorly constructed. Dragon Age is at the extreme corner of all four corners of that graph. It is great.
So it's a square.
Yeah, like, it's great as in I like it, but it is also bad as in I hate it. It's great as in it's well constructed, it's bad as in it's poorly constructed. It has so many flaws, it is at war with itself as a franchise. So one example of this is that it is often wildly racist in its handling of some things. So, for example, they have a kind of race called the Qunari, who are just supposed to be like Islam, like that's they have a philosopher called Khosloon. It's a really bad caricature, and that has to be recognized. It's shitty. There are other things that it handles well. So a lot of Indigenous people really like the way that they handle the Dalish, who are the elves, because the Dragon Age writers say that they took a lot of inspiration from both Indigenous cultures and Romani traveler cultures. But on the other hand, also there's a bunch of stuff that they get wrong with that and do very badly. It's complicated. Anyway. Dragon Age Origins, not perfect, but pretty great, especially for a game that came out before 2010 that has like bi-romance options for male and female protagonists, and talks a lot about like colonialism and the historical abuses of the church. Great game, great message, interesting stuff to say. Not perfect, but interesting. Dragon Age 2. Mm. So then Dragon Age gets bought by a bigger studio, specifically BioWare. The thing you have to know about BioWare...
I don't know about BioWare at all. I'm interested.
So they
because also... I didn't even realize that the first one wasn't BioWare. I thought it was BioWare throughout.
So no, it was like I think it was bought by BioWare just before it published, but it was developed and they basically bought a pretty much finished game. And then DA2 they developed from the start, so they had a lot more creative input from like the beginning. So here's what happened. Half of the writers quit. Half of the original writers quit because of what BioWare was doing with DA2. And what you get from DA2 is like a Dragon Age 2 is a game that is fundamentally at war with itself. Like narratively, it is completely at war with itself. The primary storyline and the storyline that most players get is very sort of pro-imperialism, pro-Christianity, anti-marginalized communities. Like it's quite... It makes me very angry in a lot of ways. The secondary storyline, which is kind of underneath that, which is in all of the like codexes and supplementary material and hidden dialogue trees that you only get if you choose certain choices, is like still kind of maintaining the origins thing of like anti-imperialism. Hey, church abuse is bad. We should protect marginalized people. They are allowed to resist genocide, etc. And I'm a medieval historian. So I was playing DA2. In lockdown, because my friends recommended it to me because they said that I'd like it. I'm so sorry. I've been rambling for so long, I haven't even like established some of the basics of the game. Shit. Sorry.
No worries.
Dragon Age is set in a medieval fantasy continent called Thedas, which is made up of various kingdoms. Most of those kingdoms are in a political alliance, and I'm going to refer to them as the South or Southern Thedas. And then in the North is Savinta, which is very much at war with the Southern Kingdoms, and also at war with their neighbor Saharon. Saharon is where the Qunari are from, which is the kind of like faux Muslim race. Savinta is basically ancient Rome. They are the only country on the continent that still actively practices slavery. And they specifically
right.
enslave elves. Elves are the marginalized people of the kind of continent in a kind of witcher way. And then the rest of the continent is ruled by the Chantry. The Twinter also has a Chantry, but I'll get into this. The Chantry is basically the Catholic Church, except like generals are switched. So instead of a male pope, there is a divine, there's always a woman. And that's because instead of Jesus Christ, they have Andraste, who is a prophet of the Maker, who is God, who sort of dies to save us all from our sins, etc. I mean, it's Christianity.
It's Christianity. It's Christian allegory at its ham-handed best.
Exactly. The kind of richest and most powerful politically southern kingdom is Orlais, which is medieval fantasy France. And that is where the seat of power of the Chantry is. So it just so happens that when Orlesians want to have, I don't know, for example, lower taxes on their imports into other countries, the Chantry like suddenly starts strong-arming the local ruler. Definitely not working together there. So the Chantry is basically an arm of the Orlesian Empire in the way that the church was for the French Empire. And that's kind of like how those politics work. The other kind of like big key thing about Dragon Age is that there are mages and magic, and Darkspawn. And mages and magic, anyone except dwarves can be born a mage. You can do magic. In Southern Thedas, mages are aggressively and violently and extensively subjugated to just wildly inhuman levels. But BioWare itself and the Dragon Age game series doesn't always want to admit that, because it's a game series that tries very hard to be like, this is a two sides issue. It is not a two sides issue. On one side is genocide, on the other side is the people perpetrating the genocide. I don't think that's a two sides issue. I'm sorry, I gotta say, I don't think that that's a moral quandary. I think that's a very simple answer to that question. If the question is, do you put a sword through a child or do you not put a sword through a child, there is an easy answer to that question. It's not hard. Anyway.
Yeah, it's like when people say, oh, the trans... And it's like, it's people... It's not a debate. It's people's lives, Barbara.
Literally.
Like fucking hell, Barbara. Like, it's like that, like, J-Ray joke where he's like, we should do genocide. We should not do that. They both have such compelling arguments.
Like, exactly. The middle ground between pacifism and genocide is murder. Like, there is no middle ground. Like, it's just not acceptable. But anyway, BioWare tries to create this false kind of, like, dichotomy between mages and non-mages, and specifically the Chantry mages, because the Chantry preachers is an original sin myth. So the Chantry preachers that the mages went into the Fade, which is basically, like, you know, the other world, and corrupted the makers.
Wait, sorry, can I just ask, was this, like, dichotomy a thing in the original one, which had basically no interference from BioWare, or was it more like leaning towards this is not two sides, just...
Well, it's, yeah, so the dichotomy was there, but they were saying it wasn't two sides. So, like, in the original one,
right,
in
origin, okay,
like, the abuse exists, the violence exists, because that was a story they wanted to explore, but there's a bit, so... I'm sorry, I don't even know how to express this, because I am really, really...
No, sorry, I just wanted context, whether this is across the board thing or just BioWare being BioWare.
Well, yeah.
Like, hey, guys, remember Anthem?
Jesus Christ. wait, no. Okay, let me summarize the answer to your question. I'm just trying to calm down and think about how I can express this clearly and concisely. Okay.
Mood. Sometimes I have to, like, stop myself. I'm like, words, okay.
yeah, genuinely, it's like I don't think that often before I speak. In Southern Thedas, if you're born a mage, you legally must live in a prison for the rest of your life. You are not legally allowed to be outside. You are not legally allowed to own property. You are not legally allowed to marry. You're not legally allowed to have children. You go to your local, like, well, to your kingdom's circle, which is like a tower, which is a prison with bricked up windows, and that is where you get to live the rest of your life, supervised by Templars, who are the Chantry's standing army. If at any point someone in your circle does something that the Chantry considers to be dangerous, unstable, or politically threatening, then the Divine, who is like the Chantry's Pope, can grant a right of annulment. A right of annulment means that the Templars, the standing army who supervise all of the mages in the circle, who can be as young as 6 and as old as like 90, are given the right to unilaterally lock the doors and slaughter every single person inside with any method that they choose. From the youngest child to the oldest person, all they have to do is just make sure that everyone is dead. On average, there are 200 to 800 people in each circle. So, and this A rite of annulment has happened within the Dragon Age universe for the last 700 years, every 50 years. So every single generation, a couple hundred mages are violently slaughtered, just culled. It is literally an ongoing genocide. It is really, really shit. Mm. In the first game...
Perpetrated by the Templars too. You know, really, really subtle there, guys.
Yeah, no, listen... This is why I keep saying it's just Christian. Like, if I thought that there were more notable differences, I would not say it, but it's just Christianity. In the first game, a rite of annulment is being attempted, and you as the player character can go and save the circle. If you choose to instead help the Templars to kill all the mages inside, then one of your companions will fight you to the death and he will die, and you will lose one of your resources because he won't let you do that. In fact, multiple of your companions will fight you to the death. They won't, like, they don't want you to do it. And if you do it, you lose, like, it becomes a lot harder to play the rest of the game.
Okay, I really appreciate that as a thing, because, like, it does, like, imply at least that there is a cost. Like, yeah. You're getting a cost in-game reflecting the sort of moral cost of your actions. I like that. See, because, like, I haven't even finished the prologue of Dragon Age Inquisition, but this is really making me want to go back.
You've got to... Oh my god. Okay. So, I... Yeah. Okay. Inquisition is a little bit of a trigger word for me. Okay, let me yeah, so in Origins it's like a big
dramatic conflict. Yes, continue.
No, it's just we have to talk about Inquisition. But in Origins it's a big dramatic confrontation. Your friends confront you about it. One of your friends is the person who was the sex worker. He was essentially a slave. And he will not argue with you to protect himself. But if you try and do this, he will literally die to save these people. And he will tell you why, because he thinks it's wrong. In Dragon Age 2, you can play a character who executes a mage for trying to prevent the rite of annulment and then does the rite of annulment. And you get to, among other things, drive a sword through your sister's body because she's a mage, and you get to kill her to cleanse her evil from the world. Yeah, it's fucked. The other ending of Dragon Age 2, and the one that everyone plays, but the one that BioWare rushed because they assumed more people would want to play the Templar ending. The other ending of Dragon Age 2 is that, yeah, no, it's this is where David Gaider comes in, and BioWare and BioWare's whole thing, because David Gaider is quite a conservative Christian in quite dangerous ways, and he has repeatedly said in interviews that he really thinks this is a two sides issue, which is fucked, because that man is really saying publicly he thinks genocide is okay sometimes. Anyway,
a little bit like,
yeah,
grim.
Yeah, most people play DA2 and pick the ending where you fight with the mages. You fight off the Templars. You stop them from killing as many mages as you can. You try to save the mages. And Dragon Age 2 as a game is all about like a city called Kirkwall, kind of falling more and more and more into like paranoia and essentially a fascist state, as the Knight Commander of the Templars essentially does a coup and takes control of the city because she is so like rabid in her hatred of mages and her like completely unreasoning hatred of mages. And you can choose to stand against her, and most people do. Dragon Age Inquisition is, what if you were literally an inquisitor for the Chantry and could lobotomize and execute mages, and you invaded the lands of the indigenous people that the Chantry did a crusade against, and you put your flag into people's lands and told them that now they were ruled by you and you represent the church in every single way? And even if you tell them that your character is like an elf who follows the elven gods who are the creators, or Canari who like maybe doesn't like have faith in Kozum but like has a different kind of faith, or a dwarf who has faith in the ancestors and the stone, you are still told that you are literally the Christian messiah and that all of the other gods are silly fictions, and that the only real god that exists in the Dragon Age universe is the Christian one, and now you must go and conquer other places for the church. And by this point...
Oh no.
And it was before Inquisition even, like... When Inquisition started development, all remaining original writers of Dragon Age quit. Like, there are no original writers of Dragon Age on Inquisition. So, Inquisition has, like, moments which are cool, and I want to be very clear, as much as I am deeply unstable about these games, I am never, ever, 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 ever gonna yell at someone for having fun with a game. It's a video game. Have fun. Like, that is your business.
It was the only one available on the PlayStation store when I searched, yeah, Dragon Age. That's why.
Well, this is part of why I wanted to do this podcast, because I have propaganda to spread, because I have a lot of friends who are in your position, who kind of started with Inquisition because it's the only one available on modern consoles, who just don't know about the others. It's quite hard to play the others, but I do think thematically and like story-wise, and especially from the position of like anyone who has ever felt like marginalized, especially from like queer and disabled narrative perspectives, Dragon Age Origins and Dragon Age 2 are genuinely really interesting and moving games that have a lot to say in really cool ways about marginalized communities' right to fight for themselves. And Dragon Age Inquisition then just spits all over that, and it's horrible. And then a lot of people play Inquisition and are like, oh, the Dragon Age franchise is kind of fine, I guess, but it seems like really weirdly like kind of, you know, pro-imperialism. And it's like, no, that's just Inquisition. Inquisition is so cursed. But yeah, I'm sorry, I've been talking for so long.
No, no. This is what the show is for.
Yeah. This is ideal.
But then, so how would people go about playing the earlier games, Origins and DA2?
So Origins and DA2 are now available on both Mac and Windows. So if you have a laptop, you can play it on your laptop. It's on Steam, and it's also on the Origin store. They're regularly on sale. You can get them plus all of the like expansions and everything for like £5. Hilariously, Dragon Age 2 introduced a downloadable strait. So the original companions of Dragon Age 2, all of them are bisexual. And all of them are written to be bi. Like, it's amazing. It's so good. I love them all so much. They are my bi crime family. But then when David Gaynor came in, because they were trying to introduce these more conservative Christian themes, they introduced a character who is extremely pro-church, violently anti-mage, and also the only heterosexual companion in the game. And you can choose to download him into your game. And so me and a lot of other fans refer to him as the downloadable straight. I know. It's gross. Fuck off, Sebastian.
Downloadable straight.
He is. He's the downloadable straight. I dislike him immensely. I will say that's a somewhat controversial opinion. Lots of people like him because his voice actor is Scottish and he has very blue eyes, but I just can't forgive the religious grooming. I just can't forgive the religious grooming. He's a fucking creep. Again, to be clear, if anyone's listening to this and is like, oh man, I live and let live, have fun. This is just my feelings. So one of the big things about Dragon Age 2, and so to kind of come back to where we were before, my friends told me that I would enjoy Dragon Age 2. I started playing Dragon Age 2. I was really enjoying it. It's a bisexual crime found family. You play as a refugee who's just arrived in the city and is completely broke and is living with your shitty uncle, and you and your sister are working for one of several crime gangs, and then you meet a bunch of misfits who are all incredibly sexy, incredibly bisexual, and also just the messiest bitches you've ever met in your entire life, all of whom are just like knee-deep in trauma and who are trying very hard to survive in like a world that does not want them to survive, and you all kind of glue together and are like, well, hey, like, you know, strength in numbers, and it's wonderful and brilliant, and they're all fantastic, and they're really well performed, they're really well written, the characterization is gorgeous, like, if you haven't played Dragon Age Origins, you don't really have a lot of context for the whole mage stuff. You don't know that there's, like, an original sin narrative about how mages, like, corrupted heaven. You don't know that all mages are legally forced to live in prisons for their whole lives and aren't allowed to have positions or money or get married or have children. So I was kind of playing through the game and, like, guessing, figuring out a lot of the, like, sort of world-building stuff, and so I needed to read a lot of like the codexes and stuff. And the more I read them as a medieval historian, the more I was going, huh, okay, so basically the Chantry is like an arm of Orlais imperialism. Cool, I understand. Like, oh, okay, like, so like all of this mage stuff is like really fucked and hypocritical and self-contradictory, because all the original writers on the game series were writing in the codexes like stuff that was sort of politically commentating on the mainstream narrative of the game. So it's like, you know, you'd have your character would have a conversation, but then you read like an extract from a book by someone who was in the Chantry 200 years ago talking about how this didn't used to be the case, and you're like, ah, I see. But most people don't bother to read those codexes, so most people don't see all of this depth. I'm trying to figure it out, and I'm texting my friends who played the game series, and they don't want to give too much away, but they're also like not really reacting. Like, I'm like, well, obviously you're on the side of the mages, right? Clearly you're on the side of the mages. Clearly the like inverted commas morally good option, because BioWare always tries to make these like moral dichotomies, is to be on the side of the mages, because the mages are like living thinking people, often children, who repeatedly express, especially in Kirkwall, which is where DA2 is set, because you spend the whole game in that city in Kirkwall, like the gallows is the circle in Kirkwall. Extensively, there are literally dozens of conversations where mages of all ages tell you explicitly that sexual abuse, rape and violence is prolific in the circles, that repeatedly mages are made tranquil, which is basically a magical lobotomy where they are removed from their ability to have emotions or magic, so they become extremely pliable because you just tell them what to do and they will just do it, and they kind of lose their
so it's like both gentling and stilling in the Wheel of Time. I can't believe there's more than one system of magical lobotomy in fantasy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the really fucked thing is, this is kind of a spoiler, so heads up. Well, actually, do you mind getting a spoiler for Inquisition? If you want to go back and play Inquisition, I don't want to spoil it for you.
No, it's been that long that I've forgotten everything about it, so I'm just going to play it fresh anyway. I don't mind spoilers.
Yeah,
we just put
totally.
Like a spoiler warning in the description, so for anyone else who may want this, this is a spoiler warning.
Thank you. So historically, the Chantry has used tranquility as like the ultimate punishment for mages. So they're still alive, but their souls have literally been severed from their bodies. Their loved ones can see them, but can no longer talk to them. They can't understand their loved ones anymore. They will betray anyone that they care about. They will do anything that they are told to do, including the Templars will often, in Kirkwall, make people tranquil so that they can sexually abuse them because they won't resist anymore. And it's really, really awful. And for a lot of mages in the Dragon Age series, it's their biggest fear. They're more frightened of being made tranquil than they are of dying. Because, you know, the idea of their body and their person being kind of used as essentially a slave by the Chantry for the rest of their existence, like, is horrifying. Mages are very frightened of tranquility, and you're supposed to not legally be allowed to be made tranquil if you go through your harrowing, which is basically a thing where a child mage, so children in the circle are called apprentices, and then when they're harrowed, they become mages. A harrowing is a thing that happens. Oh, wait, I've got so much that I need to contextualize this. In the Dragon Age universe, there is an other world called the Fade. The Fade is the realm of spirits and demons. It's also where everyone goes when they dream, except for dwarves, which is why dwarves can't do magic. The Fade is where magic comes from. The veil is the thing that divides the Fade and the living world. When mages dream, they can essentially lucid dream. They know that they're in the Fade. When everyone else dreams, they don't know that they're in the Fade. They're just dreaming. Because mages know they're in the Fade, they can be approached by spirits and demons and have conversations with them. Spirits and demons are supernaturally compelling, and specifically demons are always very, very keen to leave the Fade and get into the living world. So they will often offer mages bargains and deals and just general devil's tricks to try and convince the mage to like let them into their mind and body so they can possess them, so they can come into the real world. When that happens, a demon plus a person full of magical power equals essentially a walking bomb, and this can be very dangerous for society. So the Chantry claims that mages need to be kept in circles so they can be supervised and prevented from being possessed. Hilariously, that doesn't actually stop anyone from being possessed, and the level of trauma and emotional tribulation, like an abuse and violence and sexual abuse in the circles, means that mages are more likely to take a deal from a demon when they're in a circle than when they're not. But anyway, that's what the Chantry claims. What the Chantry does is it doesn't tell the apprentices, who are children as young as six, doesn't tell the apprentices that what's going to happen. It's just that when they turn between the ages of like 14 and 18, random children in their dormitories, they're all made to sleep in massive dormitories. Random children in their dormitories just start going missing and never coming back. And they don't know why. And what the Chantry says is, well, you can either do your harrowing, but we won't tell you what a harrowing is or how it works or why your friends keep disappearing and never coming back. Or you can volunteer for the Rite of Tranquility, which is what a good mage would do. And so a lot of these children just volunteer to be lobotomized and then are completely severed from their soul and are pliable to be Chantry slaves for the rest of their lives, and it's fucked. The ones who agree to do their harrowing are... It's horrible. In Origins, if you play the mage origin, your friend is really scared because neither of you know what a harrowing is, and he thinks that he's not been allowed to do his harrowing because they want to make him tranquil. And like, kind of one of the inciting quests is him being like, please help me, I need to convince them to harrow me so that they won't make me tranquil. It's if you agree to do your harrowing, you are taken from your room in the middle of the night by a group of armed Templars who are all primarily adult men, but some adult women in full plate armor with swords, who are deliberately addicted to a substance called lyrium, which gives them abilities that let them suppress magic, often painfully in mages by cutting them off from their magic, but also has side effects when they're addicted of paranoia and hallucinations. In the circles, every single day, mages are subjected to religious services, which the Templars are a religious order, where they are told that they are demons who always want to tempt and possess everyone, and that they are the cause of all filth and hatred in the Maker's creation. And then they are guarded by fully armed soldiers who can do whatever they want to any mage child or adult without really any consequence, who are actively experiencing paranoia and hallucinations induced by a highly addictive substance. So you can imagine how well that goes. The Chantry addicts the Templar Silurium so that they can control them, because the Chantry also controls the Lyrium supply. The Chantry is evil. Anyway, so you're taking...
That is true.
I'm glad you're with me on this. You're taken from your bed in the middle of the night between the ages of 14 and 18. If you imagine that you're a young girl, for example, and you're very aware of the sexual abuse in the circle, that's terrifying, by a group of fully armed people who tell you that you are going to be put bodily into the Fade, which is where all the demons live. And with no guidance and no instruction and no advice and no resource and no companionship, you are thrown into the Fade and told to just fight off a demon, just like with your bare hands and like magic, I guess. You're not given any training to do it. If you survive your encounter with that demon, then when you come out of the Fade, the Templars decide on whether or not they think that maybe you're possessed. See my earlier note about paranoia and hallucinations. If they think that there's a chance that you're possessed, they will run you through with their swords, because when you wake up, you are on your knees in the middle of a circle of them and their swords are on your body, ready to drive through you. And one of the Templars literally admits to you that he is not told how to tell whether or not someone is possessed. So they just kind of go by vibes, I guess. If you somehow survive this experience, you are harrowed. You are not allowed to tell anyone, and you are not allowed to see anyone that you grew up with in the apprentice dormitories, because you are moved up to another floor of the circle where you live with the mages now. But once you're harrowed, you are not legally allowed to be made tranquil. In Kirkwall, which is the setting of DA2, one of the big things is that, like, Knight Commander Meredith, who's in charge of all the Templars, is, like, arbitrarily making people tranquil even if they've been harrowed. So she's just lobotomizing people left, right, and center. Several of the Knight Captains are making people tranquil so that they can sexually abuse them. One of them, in a quest, literally admits this to you and threatens a young girl with it. It's horrible. He's proposed, literally, and this is a horrible, horrible, horrible reference, so just warning for reference to specifically the Holocaust, he calls it the tranquil solution. It's so fucked up. So, yeah. So I'm playing this game, and I'm like, well, clearly there is a right and wrong side here. I don't understand why the game keeps trying to tell me that this is a both sides issue. And then the climax of Dragon Age 2 is that a mage blows up a cathedral. But he was right. But he does blow up a cathedral. And the thing that you have to know about this game is that it was released not long after 9/11. And that, like, I think it was like a year. And that for a lot of American fans, they kind of think of this character as, like, inverted commas, a terrorist. However, as a medieval historian, that's not really how this works. Like, that's not really how terrorism works. Specifically, like, so this, he's also my favorite character in the franchise, but let me explain. This character is called Anders. He is a mage. He grew up in a circle. It was horrible. He was put in solitary confinement for a year. He has been tortured. He ran away a lot. He doesn't even have a real name. When he was brought to the circle in chains when he was 12 years old, he didn't speak for a year, so they just called him Anders because he kind of looks like someone from the kingdom of the Anderfels. He is also a spirit healer, which is a specifically rare school of magic that you can only do if you're like born with the predisposition towards it. So they're especially valuable. And in this medieval fantasy setting, spirit healers are the only people who can do things like heal internal bleeding and like complicated fractures and stuff, because otherwise they've basically got a medieval medicine level of like healthcare. Also, because of the fact that the Chantry controls the circles, only rich people can access magical healing. Only nobility can access magical healing. Now, Dragon Age 2 is about, like, kind of the aftermath of Dragon Age Origins. In Dragon Age Origins, there's an apocalypse. I haven't even touched on this, it's a long story, but basically there's these things called Darkspawn, which are essentially zombies. the Chantry claims that Darkspawn exists because the mages corrupted the Golden City and basically brought about the fall of heaven. We don't actually know why Darkspawn exists, but they do exist. They're like an armies like under the continent. It's a little bit like, imagine like Lord of the Rings, like the Dwarven cities are now completely infested with zombies. And occasionally they come up onto the like surface, led by an archdemon, which is like a kind of god dragon, and like wage war. Like they are an organized army and they wage war and try to like take over and destroy the world. In Dragon Age Origins, your character is like fighting that army in the first kingdom that the Darkspawn have appeared in. And this isn't really a spoiler because the game always has to end this way. Like, you defeat them. In Dragon Age 2, the survivors of that kingdom where the Darkspawn came up and tried to kill the world are from Ferelden. They're refugees who fled during the war. They've arrived in Kirkwall, which is like basically across the ocean. Kirkwall is a really shitty city, and doesn't want to let in any refugees. So the city is flooded with refugees who have no homes and are like horribly traumatized after everything that they've just been through. And Kirkwallers are just being horrible to Fereldens and don't want them to be there. And your character in Dragon Age 2 is a Ferelden refugee, and you are trying to like make a new life for yourself in Kirkwall. And this is why you're friends with all the like marginalized people and the criminals and people no one wants around. Anders, this mage, he is also a Ferelden refugee. But he's also a healer. So he bases himself in the slums and for 6 years is the only person that anyone who isn't literally nobility can access to get any kind of healthcare at all. This is so important to like the working class people of the city that if you try to find him, they will threaten to fight you and die for him just to protect him because he is the only person who has ever given a shit about them. He gives away all of the donations to his clinic to his patients. He gives away all of his food. There are many comments on the fact that he's malnourished. He gives free healthcare to all of the sex workers. They really like and trust him. There is dialogue about that. At one point, the Chantry, also important to say, the Chantry doesn't help the refugees. The Chantry doesn't help the poor. The only time that we see any of the priests from the Chantry in the poor part of town is for her to ask for donations to the church from a sex worker on the street. Like, there's like, also the Chantry, there's one big cathedral in Kirkwall. It closes to the public at night. And you never see any poor people in there. You only see people who literally have aristocratic titles. For 6 years.
Hey.
Yeah. So you're getting an image of like the dynamic here, right?
Mm.
So for 6 years, Anders gives healthcare to people, but he also writes a manifesto. And in his manifesto, he's trying to say, I don't think that things should be like this. Mages are oppressed. They experience horrible violence. We shouldn't be hearing consistent stories of children being raped. Like, it's horrible. It's violent. It's not just. It's not good. It's not holy. And so he writes his manifesto. For 6 years, he publishes this manifesto. He shares this manifesto with you as the protagonist. He talks to the Archbishop of the series. He talks to the Archbishop of the city. Repeatedly, and he tries to convince her to listen to him. And whilst this is happening, the city gets worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And eventually, in the final act of the game, and this is something a lot of players miss because it's thrown away by the writing because of what I've told you about how the game is at war with itself, Anders finds out that they're going to do a rite of annulment in the gallows. The gallows at that point, because a neighboring circle and neighboring kingdom had been burned down, has over 1,000 mages inside. Young as 6, old as 90. They are all going to be unilaterally slaughtered. Night Commander Meredith has written off for a rite of annulment with no justification. There hasn't been like one specific like incident. There isn't a threat to the city. She just wants to kill them because they're mages.
Mm.
Anders tries to tell you about this, but you as the protagonist aren't given the option to do anything by the game. So what happens within the narrative is he tells all of his friends and allies who he has been fighting with and risking his life with for 6 years. And you all kind of go, oh yeah, that's not really my problem. And at this point in the game, there are literally labeled, labeled enemies called Templar Death Squads, which go into the poor parts of town and just kill people. They break into people's houses and kill people if you're suspected of harboring a mage. Like, it is completely untenable. And Anders is like, okay, so Anders starts getting really depressed. I wonder why. And kind of retreats into himself. And your character is like, oh, I've noticed that you seem like really different. And he's like, you know, have you not seen the city. And eventually, in the big climax of the game, sorry, this is a super spoiler-ridden chat. At the big climax of the game, there's a lot of chaos, and he blows up the chantry, and it kills the Archbishop, Grand Cleric Althena, and a couple of other priests. Now, BioWare has kind of tried to retcon to say it killed a lot more people, but the animation of the game, what you actually see on screen, is that it's an extremely controlled blast that only destroys that building because it's like a magical explosion. So it goes up into the air and basically acts like a massive signal flare. It doesn't drop rubble on other buildings. None of the other buildings are damaged. You are standing outside the cathedral and you are not harmed by the explosion. Neither is anyone else. But it does kill the Archbishop, who by this point is the ruler of the city and has been for 3 years. And Anders literally declares himself to be the person who did this in front of Knight Commander Meredith and the leader of the Circle, First Enchanter Orsino. And he says, look, I did this. Because if I didn't do this, the people of Kirkwall will keep trying to ignore this, and I won't let you quietly kill us anymore. You can't just do that behind closed doors. So now everyone knows what's happened. It was me. I felt that I needed to do it because no one was listening to anything else I was doing. And then he turns to you as the protagonist and says, I agree that what I've done is incredibly wrong, and I will never forgive myself. You can now execute me if you'd like to. And then you can just execute him. You can just stab him in the back. You can just execute him for his crimes. And he will let you. He won't fight you. He won't defend himself. He'll just let you. And a lot of people come away from that because he doesn't tell you that he's going to blow up the church. He asks you to help him kind of get the ingredients to do this bomb, but what he tells you is that he's trying to split himself from the spirit of justice that has been possessing him for the last 6 years. And he also says to you across the game that he thinks the spirit of justice is actually a spirit of vengeance, and it's been a demon of vengeance, and it's been corrupted by his anger at the Chantry and his anger at the Circles. And there's a whole kind of storyline about him being possessed, and like what BioWare are trying to say is like, oh, maybe he's out of control and like scary and dangerous. But also, what we see throughout the game series is that demons will always defend themselves, and if you execute him, he doesn't fight back. Neither does his, inverted commas, demon. He tells you, and also there are other characters in the series who are possessed by spirits who are presented as unilaterally good, and it's a good thing. So he's the only one where they try to kind of claim that it's not. Also worth noting, the lead writer on Anders is a woman called Jennifer Hepler, who literally has said in interviews that she based him as a on her bipolar boyfriend because she specifically wanted to punish her boyfriend because she didn't like him and she thinks the bipolar people are evil, which is ableist as fuck.
Can I just interject for a second? What the fuck?
Yeah. Yeah.
May I interject for just a second? What the fuck?
I can't believe I got this far without what the fuck.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both. I feel like achievement unlocked. But yeah, no, it's fun. Also, really important thing to note, all of the companions in Dragon Age 2 are bisexual, but Anders is the only companion out of all your bi companions who has a same gender love interest who's shown on screen. So he's the only one who you actually see with someone and he talks about like loving a man. And the only one who we have talk about loving a man is also the one that BioWare wants to let you execute and is also the one that they say is the villain, which I think is also quite fucked.
A lot going on here.
Yeah, no, for real. And yeah, and so I finished that game. And I was like, well, I think he was right. I think he should have done that. And I think within the context of medieval history, this is blowing up the Houses of Parliament, right? Like, within the context of European history, blowing up a cathedral, especially when an archbishop is literally ruling the city in place of a secular ruler, because the secular ruler was killed 3 years ago and they have been ruling the city. And during their time ruling the city, they have declared a police state in which they are having their soldiers, their religious army, raid people's houses, torture and execute them arbitrarily. This is a political act. This is not blowing up a community center. This is blowing up a political building of the person ruling your city because the person ruling your city is slaughtering people. I don't see that. By definition, it's not an act of terrorism. Like, this is the act of a marginalized person trying to prevent genocide being done to themselves and their community. People are allowed in situations of violence and war to violently resist being murdered. Like, it's such a And it was really interesting to play Dragon Age 2 when I did, because it was the year that George Floyd was murdered. Obviously, by this point, like, Colin Kaepernick had taken a knee. Kind of people were more and more aware of, like, the ongoing and massive historical violence against Black communities across the UK and the US by the police and by the kind of state. And, you know, the imperial perversion of Christianity that uses propaganda to kind of claim that marginalized people should just sort of sit back and let the state murder their children, because that's what a nice, well-behaved marginalized person would do. It was increasingly clear that this was obviously just like a tool of oppression, right? Like, and I'd kind of known that for a very long time because I'm queer and disabled, but I was feeling it viscerally that year, you know, that people in marginalized communities have a right to defend themselves, and that the state's kind of decision of what constitutes moral violence and what constitutes immoral violence is always a tool of control. And the fact that BioWare is a game, BioWare is a game company, game studio, and Dragon Age 2 is a game, was trying so hard to make me agree that, like, you know, violence is never acceptable, and look at what this character just did, how evil of him, was just, like, maddening to me, because I was like, how could anyone get to the end of this game and be like, oh yeah, for sure, I think we probably should have just let the genocide happen. Like, what the fuck? And so I kind of had to go further. So I started reading all the supplementary material. I found out about this whole history of the game's developers. I found out about the kind of changes and themes over time. I found people who, like, kind of really agreed with me about, like, the themes of the game. And you know, and then I found people who I felt kind of understood it differently. And I have almost never, when it comes to media, really connected people's preferences in media with, like, what they really want to do in real life, right? Like, that's stupid. Like, people don't, like, you know, you can read the goriest, most slashery horror thing. That doesn't mean that you're actually a serial killer. That means that you just find those themes interesting to read about, and that's fine. Like, people are allowed to read and consume whatever media they want. But for the first time in my life, when I started engaging with the Dragon Age fandom, I realized that, like, I was actually real life frustrated with people who didn't understand, like, the flaws in these dichotomies. And I realized that was because, like, I am a disabled queer person who has experienced abuse and spiritual abuse, and I'm also a medieval historian. And I have a pretty strong understanding of, like, where spiritual abuse in the Catholic Church in particular comes from, towards women, towards queer people, towards disabled people. And it was frustrating me because I was like, oh, but this is cultural Christianity. This is where a lot of the violence of cultural Christianity comes from today, like, because it's not examined in people. Even people who don't consider themselves to be Christian apply Christian morals and Christian historical, like, specifically imperial Christian historical kind of values to marginalized communities. And it's used to justify and explain away and shrug off a lot of responsibility for violence and discrimination. And so I felt more and more and more and more and more strongly about it. And then also, like, I know I've presented a lot of wildly frustrating and horrifying themes, but it's also kind of, and this is on the side of, like, good as in I like it and good as in well constructed, there is so much of Dragon Age, including in Dragon Age 2, which does kind of critique all this, which does kind of ask the player to question these themes, which asks you to sympathize with marginalized people and sympathize with marginalized people's desire for violence and right to anger and grief in response to state violence. And there is a lot about, like, all of the extended kind of universe that talks about how, you know, in situations of massive injustice, it is extremely difficult to make the right choice, in inverted commas, because there isn't really a right choice. You can only make the choice to survive and to try and act with as much compassion as you are able. And sometimes you might not even make the choice to survive. And the way that the first two games in particular talk about queerness, the way they talk about abuse, the way they talk about trauma and surviving trauma is so compelling. But also, like, and this is kind of a slightly different tangent, but it's something that I really want to mention, it's also not misery porn. So, like, a thing that I love is that a lot of the characters are very funny. They are witty. They will make jokes. They will tell you about their trauma, and then they'll make a joke about it, which I think is incredibly true to life. Most people I know who talk about trauma, myself included, if I'm talking about trauma, like, it'll go into a joke because, like, hey, listen, I can't be sad all the time. And
so if you don't laugh, you'll cry. If you don't laugh, you'll cry.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But also that, like, all of these characters, like the Dragon Age 2 characters, all of them are traumatized. All of them have been through horrible abuse. One is an escaped slave. One is a woman who was sold to a rich man when she was 18. One is Anders, who was kept in solitary confinement for a year. Like, they all have, like, different ways, like, different things they've been through. But at the same time, they are also incredibly competent and charming and funny and fun to be around and, like, good at what they do and exciting and adventurous and interesting. And it's so rare in my experience to get characters, especially, like, secondary character, like companion characters in any media, who have explicitly survived things like, for example, sexual abuse, and are still allowed to be characters who have more going on than the fact that they survived sexual abuse. So, like, the fact that Dragon Age has so many, like, major characters who have been through real trauma, but also who are, like, yeah, fun, funny, cool, is just, like, wonderful to me. And then the fact that they have opinions and attitudes and feelings about the social politics of the world that they live in, and they will fight for them, and they will argue about them, and they will fight you on them, is, like, really, really
not just cardboard cutouts.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they'll make goofy jokes and puns and flirt with each other, and they will, like, you know, that they will veer from kind of being fun and silly to really serious, and you won't always know when that's going to happen, but they will, yeah, they'll stand up for what they believe in. And yeah, and so in that respect, like, weirdly, despite everything I've told you about, Dragon Age draws, like, a very large audience of, in particular, like, Indigenous, Black, queer, disabled, and female players, because they're people to whom, like, all of this stuff, like, really resonates. I would say at least 45% of the Dragon Age fandom is trans, like, because, like, those themes of, like, surviving in kind of a shitty society and feeling like you are kind of scraping by on the edge, but on the other hand, you insist on having a fucking good time while you're doing it, is so powerful and cathartic. And being able to talk about, like, use the metaphor of the Chantry to talk about the ways in which you feel that, like, Christian imperialism has negatively affected, like, your life or your community, or has in some ways kind of corrupted your worldview or the way that you think of yourself, the way you think of others, can be, like, beautiful in a lot of ways. And yeah, and then even just the fact that, like, the characters, different characters, do and don't have faith to greater and lesser degrees, and that's something that the game always kind of remembers. So, for example, Anders blows up a cathedral. He is Andrastian. He's really quite faithful. He really sincerely believes in the church, and he talks about it in his manifesto. He tries to find, because he believes that Andraste, who, by the way, like, led an army to free a bunch of slaves, so I'm pretty sure wouldn't approve of, like, what her church has done, but it's, like, again, great parallel to Christianity and, like, Jesus Christ's teachings versus Christian imperialism. Like, Anders really wants to find ways, like, within the texts of his own religion to kind of feel that he should be allowed to live, that people like him should be allowed to live, and he quotes them and references them in his arguments. There are other characters who aren't faithful at all, or who are kind of agnostic, or who believe in other faiths. So there's a character called Meryl in DA2 who's an elf. She really believes in the creators, who are, like, the Dalish, like, the elven gods. And that's a pantheon rather than monotheistic. And that's really important to her, and she will tell you about different traditions and different gods and why they matter. And like I already mentioned, Leliana, who's the one who kind of like has the radical opinion that like, hey, maybe the church should accept everyone. Then there are characters like the person who kind of survived like all this abuse, Zevran. And Zevran's an assassin and was bought as a child. And he is like wildly nihilistic in some ways. Like he's nihilistic, but in a kind of nothing in life matters, but everything is hot pink and glittery kind of way. Like he will make a million jokes before admitting that he genuinely does think that nothing matters. But like Zev's an atheist, or at least like strongly implied to be. On the other hand, like the only memory he has of his mother is that she was Dalish, and I think he's very interested in. He says he's very interested in a Dalish faith, but certainly when you play the game, he's not in that place. There's a character who's human who was a Templar and quit after he was being trained to be a Templar because he was being raised in a chantry, and he was invited to attend Wand Harrowing, and he was like, this is the most fucked up thing I've ever seen, and quit and just escaped. And he is one of the most critical characters of the chantry and the Templar order in the entire franchise. Every conversation you have with him is him being like, well yeah, they're clearly corrupt. Yeah, like it's just, I think it's something that's really cool. I think that even for people who like don't believe in anything, and like I'm personally agnostic, if you live in like the British Isles, for example, or Europe, like or America, Christianity has an enormous influence on our education system, on our laws, on our social and moral values, on our state, in a way that can sometimes be quite hard to see because it's so pervasive. And having something that explores that and talks about that in what is also like a very queer, very like in a lot of ways also very well thought out in terms of its world building and kind of nuances and the cultures that are there and the schools of magic and why they're there and how they're there, like kind of world, and very funny, like well-written world with lots of like really thoughtful, caring, fun, interesting, brave, kind characters, is like weirdly joyful whilst also making me angrier than almost anything else, but like in a fun way, but sometimes in just an angry way, but it also in a fun way.
I feel like, yeah, the way you said that, like it's not like misery porn, because I feel like when you're dealing with like something as dark as series and with themes as dark as that, I can imagine like it would probably be easy to go like entirely dark, but like you said, like the characters are allowed to be characters, like despite having experienced like, you know, like all this trauma, like is really like that's pretty good, and it doesn't always happen.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's kind of unusual in my experience. Like I'm always drawn to stories about characters who've been through trauma because I've been through trauma, but I find that in a lot of media what happens is either the fact that they've been through trauma is the only thing that they get to have about them ever, and it's like the only thing that like defines them ever and motivates them ever, or they have been through something which is objectively and quite horrifically traumatizing, but they are like written in a way where they just like act like, anyway, that was like meaningless. And it's like, well, that's not, you can't like, you know, you have this like classic kind of like character who'll be like, yeah, so I was like raised in a prisoner of war camp where I was forced to be a slave in like a labor camp for like my entire childhood, and I never knew my family, and I was beaten daily. Anyway, I'm completely chill about that. Let's have a conversation about candy. And it's kind of like, well, like on the one hand, yeah, for sure, like people who've been through trauma like have other things. On the other hand, they probably do care. Like it'll be a thing where then that character works with the people who enslaved them, and it's like, this does not even register enough for me to raise it in conversation. And it's like, no, like they would have an issue with that. Like it's something that's where fan fiction comes in, where like a lot of the time I'll kind of, you know, I can't help but watch shows and like care about the characters enough to be like, I don't think that this character would be comfortable with doing this thing that they specifically have trauma with, at least without saying anything, or like at least if they're not saying anything, it should be a thing that they are hiding it, like and what I really like about Dragon Age is it does a very good balance of like sometimes shit happens and like your companions, like they will say, oh, I'm not really sure I want to do this, or like, how could you agree with him, or like, how could you talk to this person, or why would you do that, you know what they did to me, kind of thing. But then on the other hand, Like, they have an ongoing betting game about the color of one of the companions' underwear. And they have, like, a series of jokes about how they're gonna, like, kind of, like, cheating at cards, how the dog keeps beating them at cards because it's a very clever dog. Like, you know, silly things. Like, freaking Anders is, like, referred to by one of the companions as Sparkle Fingers because of a brief period that he met her in a brothel. Like, he has a spicy shimmy, which he will offer to do instead of doing magic for you because he can't just do magic on the street. Like, it's a silly and fun and funny series. And also, it will save
There's a lot going on.
Yeah, like, it's just, yeah. It's cool, and I like it.
It sounds cool.
Thanks for letting me talk about it for so long.
That's what we're here for.
If you were to tell someone who is new and wanted to get into Dragon Age, like, where would you say for them to start? Like, how would you get them into it?
I would really recommend, if you want to get into Dragon Age, start with Dragon Age 2. In my opinion, Dragon Age 2 is the best movie of the franchise. It's quite linear, it's pretty simple, and even though you're starting in the middle of the franchise, I do think a lot of the context kind of fills in. Plus, in terms of, like, just characters and humor, the, like, drama side of it is really well done. I would then say go back to Dragon Age Origins. I think Dragon Age Origins is the best game of the franchise. Dragon Age Origins has really great replay value because the story changes quite substantially depending on which background you choose. You can play as a dwarf, an elf, or a human, and you can play as a mage or a warrior. That means that you just, like, have a lot of options to explore kind of the world of Dragon Age and get to know it better. Also, like, Dragon Age 2 is very contained because it's all in Kirkwall, so you don't have to, like, learn that much information, whereas in Origins you're kind of going through the whole of Ferelden and you learn a lot more about, like, the world in general, which is really cool. But Origins is, like, longer, it's kind of more detailed. It's quite an old game, so I will say that, like, you have to go into it with that sense that it is, like, quite an old PC game. And then, like, once you played those two, if you'd like to, you can play Inquisition. Inquisition is definitely the most, like, beautiful in terms of graphics, and the most sophisticated in terms of technology. It came out, like, I think nearly a decade after the first two. And it does have some really moving cutscenes and some really cool decisions that have big impact on the world. However, like, kind of the warning I would put in is, like, outside of my own personal feelings about the themes of the game, from a game design perspective, Inquisition can feel like a bit of a slog sometimes. It's open world, but not always in a well-designed way, and can be quite difficult to, like, move from one point of the story to the other. And so I probably wouldn't start there. And this is why I'm kind of sad that a lot of people do, because I think a lot of people kind of get into Inquisition and maybe pour, like, 10, 15, 20 hours into it and then get a bit frustrated and kind of drop it, and often drop it sooner because of this, like, they didn't quite balance the open world versus, like, narrative well. And so it can be, like, a bit of a headache to actually play through. But, you know, if you play DA2, if you play Origins, if you play both of them and you enjoy them, then, like, it's worth going back to Inquisition and being like, okay, like, now you will enjoy it because you will kind of know what the world building is doing and why this is significant and why it's cool to see Liliana and, like, stuff like that. Yeah, there are, like, books. There was also a Netflix TV show that came out, Dragon Age Absolution. That was the worst TV show I've ever seen in my entire life. Oh my god, it was so bad. Don't watch it. Just don't watch it. Just don't watch it. You have other things to do with your life. You fresh life on this earth. Don't watch it. It's bad. It's just badly made. It's not even that it has bad themes. It's just so badly written and animated. Like, I don't know why anyone thought that was worth making. Like, I was so excited about Dragon Age TV series. I watched it as soon as I could, and oh my god, it's so bad. So, like, but it exists for sure. And there are some spin-off Dragon Age comics and novels. Hilariously, a bunch of really important plot details for the series and world-building details are in the novels. The novels are kind of fine. Like, there are some interesting things about them, but they can be thematically a bit frustrating sometimes. Same is true with the comics. There's a really cool one about Fenris, who's from Dragon Age 2, who's really great. Yeah, I would say both the novels and the comics aren't really going to mean much to you until you've played at least one of the games. So I would say DA2, because it's nice and linear and cinematic. I think it's compelling narratively, and it'll make you interested enough in the game series that if you do want to play it more, the others you can play and they are more of a game experience than Origins, because that's like a fun game even though it's quite old and has like more detailed world. And then Inquisition, because by that point you'll have enough like Inquisition and the comics and the novels and stuff, because you'll have enough incentive to like actually care about those if you do want to.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well,
I introduced myself.
So what about this role-playing game then?
So
yeah, tell us about that.
I am a game designer. The Dragon Age role-playing game, in a lot of ways, is the worst laid-out manual that I've ever seen in my entire life. I don't know why they did it like this. There are, like, several crucial pieces of information that you need that are represented in neither the contents nor the index, and they're not even bolded in the body text, so you just have to kind of find them in the middle of a page. It is so hard to use the Dragon Age role-playing game manual. It is wild. That said, I am currently GMing a campaign, and I do think it is quite a fun adaptation of the video game. Like, it really feels like you are playing the video game in some ways. It's got quite a neat, simple system. It just uses D6s. There are other sides of it that are quite crunchy, so there's a lot of rules about, like, magic, what your spells are, spending mana and stuff like that. So if you like a kind of more crunchy system, so, you know, your D&Ds, your Pathfinders, etc., then I think you'll probably enjoy the Dragon Age tabletop game. If you like Dragon Age the video game series, I think you'll definitely enjoy the tabletop game. There's a lot that's really cool about it. And it's just cool being able to, like, you know, my partner has been into Dragon Age for, like, oh gosh, I don't even know, since they were 17, and they, like, just for both of us, like, being able to do a Winter's Grasp whilst we're playing, because we both know what that is in the video game, and I've written a lot of Dragon Age fanfiction, being able to, like, say I'm gonna do Winter's Grasp now is just fun. Also, there's kind of cool stuff, so, like, in the role-playing game manual, there's a whole setup for running a tournament, a medieval tournament. And I personally think that A Knight's Tale is one of the best films of all time. And being able to just run a Knight's Tale Dragon Age arc is very fun for me personally. I think there's a lot of cool stuff. Also, like, oh man, I haven't even mentioned, but, like, so Dragon Age has one of, in my opinion, the kind of best, most interesting, most genuinely cool and badass, like, orders of knights in any media that I've ever encountered. And I'm a medievalist and a nerd, so I've encountered several. So in Dragon Age Origins, you play as a Grey Warden. Now, the Grey Wardens are an apolitical, pan-continental group of people whose job it is to wait for when the Darkspawn try to come up into the world and start an apocalypse, and then to lead, like, the forces of good in resisting them. But the really important thing you need to know about the Grey Wardens is that because they are apolitical and pan-continental, they can conscript anyone, regardless of what they've done, including, like, tyrants, kings, people about to be executed, people who have broken many laws, murderers, traitors, anyone. They can conscript anyone, mages. And then that means that all of the Grey Wardens are criminals and queer people and marginalized people and people who had nowhere left to go, people who were homeless and sex workers and runaway mages. And those are the greatest heroes of the world. Like, you meet a Grey Warden and everyone respects them more than anything. Their symbol is a silver griffin. Their motto is in peace, vigilance, in death, sacrifice, in war. No, wait, no, I've done it the wrong way around. In peace, vigilance, in war, victory, in death, sacrifice, oh, whatever. It's really, really, really cool. And they, their whole thing is that they, this is a minor spoiler for Origins, but it's, like, it happens in the first quest of the game. They are, like, in order to fight the Darkspawn, which, as I've said, are essentially magic zombies, they consume a little bit of Darkspawn blood, which means that they are slowly becoming Darkspawn themselves. But whilst they're doing that, they are able to, like, hear the Darkspawn hive mind, so they know whenever they're close by, but they can also hear each other. And they are, like, they have, like, superhuman strength, superhuman speed. They maybe can see in the dark a little bit. But, like, they are all now dying. Like, they will eventually become, like, they will succumb to that infection. And what they do when they kind of get close to that, they refer to it as the calling, is they go down into the Deep Roads, which is like what used to be the Dwarven cities but have now been overtaken by the Darkspawn, and they just try to kill as many of the Darkspawn as they can before they're destroyed, and like that is how a Grey Warden like ends, if they're not killed on the battlefield first. They are trusted by all nations. Well, they're theoretically trusted by all nations, but most nations don't like the fact that they are apolitical and pan-continental. They can turn up anywhere and conscript anyone. They don't care whether you're an elf or a human or a dwarf. In the world of Dragon Age, elves are really discriminated against. In the Grey Wardens, elves can have any rank and be of any level of importance. They're actually treated as equals. The same is true of mages. The Grey Wardens will defend each other to the death. They are like, they are just this found family of marginalized people and criminals who everyone loves because they save the world and they're heroes. It's so cool.
Would you like a book recommendation?
Yes.
This is one of the lesser done segments of the podcast, where I recommend.
Nigel recommends a book.
If you like the whole Grey Wardens consuming like the blood and then slowly becoming the thing that they're going to that they swore to destroy, I think you might enjoy the Knights of the Borrowed Dark series by Dave Rudden. It's like an Irish kind of YA urban fantasy ish storyline.
Okay, that sounds rad.
Yeah. There's one sequence in the second book where they blow up the long room at Trinity, which is hilarious now as a Trinity student. Well, ex-Trinity student. I graduated. I didn't drop out.
Cool. I've written it down. I love the Grey Wardens. And so in the tabletop game, one of the things that can happen is once you get to a high enough level, your character, like if you work with your GM, because people don't choose to become a Grey Wardens. You can't even choose to become a Grey Wardens. The Grey Wardens won't let you. They don't take recruits. They conscript or nothing. Like you can kind of work with your GM if you want your player character to become a Grey Warden, and there are mechanics for becoming a Grey Warden. It's very cool. You can explore the whole continent. There's a map of the whole continent. Like, it's just, it's good. There's places that we haven't yet been in the Dragon Age video game franchise. Like Navara and Rivain and the Anderfells and Saharon and Tevinter. Though I don't want to go to Tevinter, fucking slavers. It's cool kind of like within the tabletop game to kind of be able to explore the world more, and also to be able to in my case, like, I'm playing a game with some other people who feel as strongly about Dragon Age as I do, and that means that we can kind of create a story that fixes some of the things that make us very angry about the video game series. Like, for example, in Inquisition, off the back of Andis blowing up the Chantry, but actually not because of that, and this is the thing about important details being put in the novels, the mages found out that the Rite of Tranquility can be reversed, and that the Chantry has known that for 700 years and just hasn't told anyone, so that mages will literally complete suicide or kill each other to save themselves from Tranquility, because the Chantry has told them that it's permanent when they know that it's not. And when the Circles found that out, they voted to dissolve. They voted for the Chantry to like abolish the Circles, and the response to that was that the Templars on guard, tried to attack and kill all of the leaders of all the Circles in Thedas, and then B, separated from the Chantry and began to just like go rogue and like just try and like kill every mage. And so all of the Circles kind of collapsed. The mages escaped into the countryside. And what is now happening in Inquisition is that the mages are like running for their lives. They have nowhere to go because, as I mentioned previously, they're not allowed to own property or money. So they have no money. They don't have trades. Most of them have never been outside. They haven't experienced weather before. And so they're just like let loose on Thedas, like on the continent. And they, you know, some of them have children, and they have no weapons, and they just have the clothes on their backs. And yeah, they have magic powers, but magic is also something that can be drained and run out. It is a finite resource. And the Templars have full plate armor and swords and shields and an organized army that has been specifically trained to kill mages. And the Templars are just pursuing the mages across the countryside, trying to kill as many of them as possible. And on the way, just like murdering random like farm owners, innocent people, like just random like entire villages, setting fire to villages. And this is referred to in Inquisition as the Mage Templar War. And I'm like, I'm sorry. By definition, a war is not one side is running for their lives and simply wants to live and is made up of children and civilians and has no weapons except for the clothes on their back. And one side has weapons and armor and is made up of adult trained soldiers. And their exclusive desire is to slaughter all of the other side. That's not a war. That's a genocide. By definition, that's a genocide. And in Inquisition, a lot of the plot is about, well, both sides are as bad as each other in the Mage Templar War. So we really need to, like, you know, think about how evil the mages are in the Mage Templar War. And it's like, buddy, like it's true that, like, the mages, like, might set fire to a town or something because they're defending themselves from being slaughtered. But this wouldn't be a problem if they weren't being slaughtered. Like, it's a whole thing. Anyway, so in our game, for example, it is not the Mage Templar War. Like, that is not what we are calling that. That is not how that is being handled. Yeah, just kind of being able to, like, address the themes that we all really care about in Dragon Age and, like, the characters and the cultures and the world building, which are also cool and interesting, whilst also not kind of accepting the, yeah, this is a two sides issue. It's just not a two sides issue. It's just not.
Just really isn't, like
if
like
you...
It's good that you do that, but it's a bit worrying that, like, players of, like, an external thing are the ones to take it into their own hands and recontextualize that this is not a war, you know?
Yeah, 1000%. And, like,
this is the, like, nowhere in the official canon is there, like, a definitive stance from the people who make it that while the people doing this think it's a war, that it's just the, like, organized, systemized slaughter of refugees.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And that's bad. Like, that, I know this is a major thing, but it's just like it's a game and you're just looking at BioWare and you're like, oh, that's bad.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fun. It's one of those things.
In so many words.
Yeah, like, and this is why I hate Inquisition a little bit. Like, there are redeemable features of Inquisition, but overall, I just hate it. I don't like the fact that it exists. And it's just, there's so much of it that's just like, what? Oh my god. And yeah, and then the fact that David Gaider has repeatedly said, yeah, it's a both sides issue. It's just like, well, I don't trust you as a person in real life. Like,
just no.
Yeah. Hmm.
As we sort of draw towards a landing point for this episode, how then does this all make you feel towards Dreadwolf, which I suppose they're going to make at some stage, the announced fourth game?
Yeah.
You feel about the future of this series?
Oh, that's a good question, because, look, on the one hand, I don't trust that it'll be good. I don't trust that it'll be good either in a well-constructed way or in a way that, like, has themes that I agree with or think are respectable. I will probably still want to play it, because I'll want to, like, you know, I wish that BioWare understood why people like Dragon Age. And they very clearly don't. And it's one of those situations where a franchise...
Yeah.
Right, like, it's a situation where a franchise very badly doesn't want its audience to be the audience that they are. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the whole thing of, like, often male TV showrunners hate it when their predominant fandom is fangirls. Like, this was really a case of the Supernatural. Like, the Supernatural showrunners hate women. And they hated that the reason they were successful was because women and queer people liked their show. And, like, it's kind of a thing with Dragon Age where, like I said, like, the people who actually keep Dragon Age relevant and care about it and, like, make fan works and stream the game and play the RPG are queer people and disabled people and people of color and women and trans people who like resonate with and relate to the stories of the marginalized characters and the stories of like survival and resistance and humor and courage in the face of discrimination and violence. And what BioWare, the audience BioWare wants is kind of a Call of Duty audience. What they want is kind of cis straight white guys who really want to kill things. And that's not the audience they have, but they keep making video games for that audience. And I wish that Dreadwolf would be a game that was like, that was for us, that went back to the heart of Origins, that was once again about like kind of the freaks and geeks on the edges of society being weirdos like we are, and kind of scraping a living and being gay and doing crimes, the video game. But I don't think that's what Dreadwolf is going to be. I think Dreadwolf is going to try really hard to be machismo and murder and violence, and this is how you have the biggest sword in the world. And that'll be fine. I don't think it'll be good. I don't think that that many people will care, because like those players aren't attracted to this game series. And the players who are attracted to this game series don't like that in a game. So, like, yeah, I wish I could believe that it would be better than it will be, but I'm quite sure that it'll be a bit shit. Maybe I'll be surprised. And if I am, I will probably text you and be like, hey, can I come back on the show to talk about Dreadwolf? Because it's actually amazing and this is why. But
I'll do a follow-up episode.
Yeah.
Have you encountered our April Fool's episode?
No.
So we didn't do one this year because of sort of scheduling things, but we did an April Fool's episode called Hyperfixations, which is you come on and talk about something you just despise. So
yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Next year.
So either way we could be getting a Dreadwolf episode down the line.
Yeah, please give me an outlet. I need one. So when I was at my peak Dragon Age hyperfixation, I'm still like, I'm very neurodivergent, but when I was at my peak, I wrote a 140,000 word fanfic in a week about Dragon Age 2, in which I wrote an entire fake manifesto for Anders. That is longer than the Fellowship of the Ring. Wrote it in a week.
Yeah, I was about to say, that is yeah, like novel length.
That is, yep. That is.
And
really,
you wrote that in a week?
Yeah. I lost control.
I am so in awe of you right now.
Same.
You know, I'm just so normal about this video game series. But yeah, so I'm sure I'll have strong feelings about Dreadwolf. Yes, we shall see. And also, I'm not sure that it'll ever come out. Like, I mean, they've been saying it'll come out for like at least 5 years, I think. Well, no, like longer. Like, it's who knows? Who knows if it will ever be freed from development? But yeah, if it does arrive, we shall see. In the meantime, I will continue to read and write fan fiction and meta and essays about the game series and replay it. I've replayed it so many times, both Origins and DA2. I can't face Inquisition. I can't face it again. Like, I can't do it.
Cannot do that again.
Yeah, no, I can't. It made me so angry. Like, I've never played a video game where I've wanted to break my TV, not because the difficulty was challenging or the boss fights were hard, but because the narrative writing made me so angry that, like, I wanted to throw something at my TV. It's just, yeah. But I played it. I will keep replaying the DA2 and Origins. I will keep GMing this campaign of the Dragon Age game. And I will continue to love it and hate it in equal measure for all time.
Really is just one of those things.
Mm-hmm. It was like, I was talking to a friend of mine about it, and I said to her that I was hoping to come on your show And she kind of joked, like, yeah, you should play this game. It makes me unspeakably angry, is like how I generally talk about it. But that is how I convinced her to play it. So, you know, like, there's sometimes it's good to have healthy outlets for your righteous anger.
Sometimes,
yeah, sometimes it works.
Sometimes when things are frustrating, like, it kind of, I feel like when you like things, it can make the, like, because, like, if something is just bad all through, you kind of might be a bit like, okay, whatever, but, like, when there are parts of Dragon Age that are as good as they are, and then there are just other things that are just so wrong.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like, if it was 5% worse than it is, it is good when it's good. If it was like 60% worse than it is when it's good, then like I wouldn't care so much, because like it would just kind of be like, but it's so, there's so much of it that's so well thought through and so well executed that, yeah, like when it's bad or when it makes a dumb choice, it's just like, what are you doing? Why don't you understand your own characters? Like, why don't you understand your own world? But on the other hand,
have either of you seen the film 10 Cloverfield Lane?
No,
I haven't actually.
Because this is it for me. I understand exactly what you're saying. This is, yes. Where I love that film so much, but it was like going to be a completely unrelated thing. And then sort of they, like, in the same way that BioWare bought out, the indie dev team. This was completely like unrelated film. And then like at the last minute, they decided it was going to be a Cloverfield film. So for most of the runtime, you get this like fantastic, tense, like locked room thing. Like it's one setting, you know, it's this underground bunker where Mary Elizabeth Winstead wakes up to, like, John Goodman brought her into this bunker and he's like, oh no, the end of the world has happened, you know, and so I saved you. You were in a car crash. I saved you because, like, the world has ended out there and it's just us. And then it slowly unravels where it's like, this dude is not telling the full story. And it's great. And then, like, the last 10 minutes of the film, it reminds you that it's, oh, this is actually a Cloverfield film. And I'm like, fuck. Like, it's a 2-star, 5-star film for me.
Oh, no. Oh, gosh.
If I could just guess an edit without that, it would be, like, the perfect film for me.
Because I remember the first time I saw the film Halloween Ends. I saw it twice in cinema. Like, I saw it with my flatmates and I really didn't enjoy it. I was kind of, like, I enjoyed parts of it, but like I was kind of like, this is not really a good film. Then I saw it again with my brothers and I felt like I enjoyed it a bit more this time. But then that also made it more frustrating because I saw the aspects of it that had potential. So I'm like, maybe I was better off just, like, not really liking it.
Yeah, yeah, no, see, that's exactly the thing. And the thing is that after all of the pain and tribulation and mental anguish that Dragon Age has put me through, I wouldn't take it back for the world. I love this game series, but also, oh man, I wouldn't be this angry about it if I didn't, like, just buy into it 1,000%. And yeah, like, it is... I remember not long before I finished DA2, I just had downloaded I'd found every supplementary material and I bought myself just a whole bottle of rosé and I sat down and I was like, I'm not even going to do any quests. I'm not even going to walk around. I am literally just going to go through the menu and read every single piece of supplementary material and make notes so that I can, like, analyze the historical and political context of this game within its own world. Like, what, like,
that is dedication.
I'm not normal about this game. There's a fictional historian in Dragon Age called Brother Genitivi, and I'd read a lot of his writing in Dragon Age 2 because you know, he's a historian. He's a historian for the Chantry, but he's so great. He reminds me a lot of the Venerable Bede, who is one of my favorite actual historical figures. And
Venerable Bede is fucking brilliant.
Yes, thank you. The Venerable Bede is my king. I cried when Bede died. I mean, I know he died in 741, but like. At the end of...
Okay, hold on. Whoa, 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 whoa. Stop the podcast. Has Ella just revealed that she is 1,000 years old?
No, like...
This is the biggest plot twist since we found out that Nigel was
another
Michael Myers.
Hyperfixations. Oh my god.
In Historia Ecclesiastica, or most editions of Historia Ecclesiastica, there is included at the end a letter from one of his students talking about the day he died, and it's really moving. Mm. And also because the thing about Historia Ecclesiastica is that like Bede tries really hard to be like neutral the whole way through, because he sincerely believes that accurate history is good faith. Yeah. Well, but specifically, yeah. is holy, is an act of faith, and so he tries so hard to be unbiased. But as he gets closer to his own time, he starts getting more invested because it's relevant to him. But what's really funny is that you like feel like you get to know him, because he goes from being neutral to being more and more like his voice comes through more and more. Like, so there's a bit where like he's talking about like the king of a neighboring kingdom, and he's like, ah, this guy's evil, he's terrible, these are all the injustices, and he thinks that like blah 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 blah. And then he clearly kind of realizes that he's gotten very biased, and so the next page is him being like, but I've also heard that he's a very good husband and father. And it's just really funny.
he's like I may have gotten a bit heated.
Yeah, it's really sweet. Like, that... I love people. But Jenna TV.
That reminds me of just there's a Darrow O'Brien bit where he talks about how the news attempts, for some reason, like modern news media, like has this attempt at balance where it's like they'll tell the news and then they'll have someone who just believes the worst things ever come on, you know, or it's like,
yeah,
they'll have this astronomer guy on and they'll, you know, they'll be talking about the planets and this. And now we turn to Barry, who believes that the sky is a carpet painted by God.
Yeah, no, I mean, the false balance, don't get me started on false balance in media. I have a master's degree in broadcast journalism, and like, oh my god, but it's not accurate. It's bad journalism. Jenna TV is basically
brother Jenna TV.
Yeah, he's Dragon Age Bede. He's really funny. He's got a very dry sense of humor, and he's very kind of like he's very much on the side of marginalized communities. He will often kind of like subtly critique the Chantry, even though he is like a member of the Chantry. He will kind of be like, and I wonder why people had a problem with this, reader. And so he's great. So I was reading his stuff with this like kind of evening where I went through the codexes. He is a character you actually meet in Dragon Age Origins. I was so excited to meet Brother Jenna TV. He is a celebrity to me. Like, Brother Jenna TV is everything. He's so great. Like, he's everything I want the Chantry to be. I don't remember why I started on this tangent, but Jenna TV, like all the real ones, respect Jenna Brother Jenna TV. He's just, yeah. He's so great.
I go. Like, I think that's a good wrap it up, unless you have anything else.
I mean, I could go on for hours, but I should stop.
If we ever go for the record for the world's longest, like, continuous podcast, it would just be Ella talking about Dragon Age for... 40 hours. I think the record is like 38 hours. It's like 38 hours, but I think we should beat it with a comfortable margin where people then look at it and go, okay, that is too much.
Yeah, good round number.
Mm.
So, Ella, where can we find you? Is there anything you'd like to share? Anything you want to plug, social media or anything?
Oh yeah, for sure. So you can find me at GEJWatts on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, WATTS. There is actually, so there's two things. I work for a fitness gaming app called Zombies Run, which is free to download and doesn't come with crappy adverts. It's basically all
I love Zombies Run.
Yeah, so I'm a director there. I recommend Zombies Run. We just launched a thing called Marvel Move, which is paid for, but it's going to be pretty cool. It's a bunch of Marvel characters that you get to hang out with, and like a bunch of new original Marvel stories. One of the series I'm directing is the X-Men, where you are a mutant and the X-Men kind of save you, and then you end up joining the X-Men. It's pretty cool. My personal thing is I've just sent to the printer my tabletop game Up River Down River, which is about sort of marginalized people rebuilding peace in the ruins of war whilst also sailing a ship on a magical, beautiful river. It's called Up River Down River. You can get it from MacGuffin and Company as a PDF or a hardback book. and I'm really proud of it. It's
Wait, yeah. Is MacGuffin and Company the one run by Johnny and Sasha?
Yeah. They were the people who recommended I play Dragon Age 2. It's their fault.
Yet another thing we can blame Jonathan Sims for.
Yeah. blame Johnny for Dragon Age 2. To be fair, definitely that was a team effort from them both, but they did. It is their fault. It is absolutely their fault. So.
I have emotional beef with Jonathan Sims.
I think a lot of people do.
Just Nigel, where can we find you?
So you can find me on Twitter at SpicyNigel. That's the main place where I am. I've been tweeting about Francis Bourgeois, the train guy, being beyond cringe. when the class wars come, I've been really on like a class wars kick, because the tweet before that was also about the best guillotines are the ones you build yourself. And also the fact that I met the director of Evil Dead Rise yesterday.
Ooh.
Yeah, he's Irish. Oh.
Cool.
Love that.
Yes.
Love that term.
Yeah, so that's me.
You can find me on Twitter at AliCat_. Ali spelt like alleyway, cat spelt with a K. And you can find me on Instagram at Ali, Ally_K_Keegan. You can find the podcast at HyperFixationsP on Twitter.
Or at HyperFixations Pod on Instagram, rate and reviews wherever you get your podcast, be that Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or as a tie-in game for a film, wherever. If you would like to come onto the show to discuss one of your HyperFixations, please feel free to reach out at any of the aforementioned social media. If you like the show, tell a friend. If you didn't, nobody likes a fucking nerd.
And that's all for this week. Ella, it was an absolute pleasure to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Signing off.